dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. We have been riveted by what has emerged as one of the hottest of the battle fronts in that war, namely Egypt in recent days. And whenever the subject turns to Egypt, we turn to Raymond Stock. He is one of our country's leading experts on that country, having lived there for some 20 years. He is currently a Middle East Forum Shulman Ginsberg Writing Fellow and the author of numerous works and translation, but also now shortly a biography of Naguib Mahfouz, the Nobel Prize-winning Egyptian literature winner. And he's been following very closely, in fact, recently wrote a very, very provocative and comprehensive treatment of this issue for FoxNews.com. Raymond, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Frank, for having me back as well. Thank you.
Tell us really, in the shortest of short forms, if you can, what we should make of what is happening in Cairo and other parts of Egypt at the moment, vis-a-vis the Muslim Brotherhood and this government that is at the moment cracking down rather harshly in ways that are being condemned by many.
Well, this is the fruit of a very long struggle between the Muslim Brotherhood and other forces in Egypt that, for control of the country, obviously, and the Muslim Brotherhood has lost this round. And they may take the country into civil war to regain what they had just about a month ago or so, a month and a half now. Mohamed Morsi, the first elected so-called president, I'm not sure he was really elected very fairly, but he was elected formally, first president to be elected and to run the country. And he made such a mess of it, and largely because he was not so much incompetent as he was actually trying too hard to consolidate Islamist control of the country and to institute a program of complete Sharia law and to consolidate the base of the Muslim Brotherhood in its rule of Egypt as a springboard for other countries as well.
Yeah, they had been waiting a long time for this moment, and they were clearly intent on seizing the day. I'm struck by something you said, Raymond Stock, because it is not widely said by others who are ostensibly knowledgeable about this subject. We're told that the elections were free and fair, and that Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood simply had an overwhelming measure of support from the Egyptian people. You've introduced a measure of doubt about that.
Well, actually, I consistently said that the Muslim Brotherhood won the election and it's a very narrow victory that they achieved in the last election, the presidential election of May of 2012, which led to Morsi being now confirmed as president on June 30th. Actually, the vote was about 50-51% for Morsi, and the military was counting at the time. There were no independent observers, no monitors, and the military was at that point in alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood. The military is actually quite full of Islamists, and they were largely in agreement with Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood in many areas. Except they have their own business interests, and they tend to be a bit more nationalist than Ummah oriented. The Muslim Brotherhood is more or less determined to establish a caliphate, very determined to establish a caliphate, but more or less oriented in that direction in terms of it was in power to have its foreign policy sort of ambiguously pointing in that direction. And they were not so much into that. They have a tradition of being very nationalist.
Yeah. And let me ask you about that, Raymond Stock, because I have been hearing from some of our colleagues and friends that, in fact, as you say, the military does have Islamists in its midst, not surprisingly, given the makeup of the public upon which it draws for its soldiers. But among them prominently is this General al-Sisi, who now runs the government of Egypt. Is the difference between them fundamentally this a matter of their nationalist Islamists in that order, and therefore horrified by the sort of universalist Islamism of the Brotherhood?
Well, I think that people are people, and they're complicated. You know, you can be an Islamist and also have the tendencies, and I think this is what Assisi demonstrates. He is an Islamist, according to his 2006 thesis, which he wrote at the US Army War College, which is now apparently classified.
I think it's now been made public, but for a time it was classified.
Yes, and that in fact was quite a revelation. At the same time, people knew he was very pro-Islamist because Morsi appointed him because he was an Islamist as Minister of Defense. And his wife wears a niqab, which is a full body covering and everything. But when he took power and you know July 3rd, he also sort of got close to the Anwar Party, which is one of the main Salafi parties, at least the main Salafi party. But that sort of stands in somewhat of an opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood and its own aspirations and goals to run the country. So that might have been an interesting interplay between the two of them, more than it was a reflection on his particular loyalties. It's hard to say for sure. It may mean something there.
But let me ask you, Raymond, and again, Raymond Stock is an expert on Egypt, a man living in Egypt for many years, now back in the United States and associated with the Middle East Forum, where he works as its Shulman Ginsberg Writing Fellow. He has a piece fresh off the presses at foxnews.com. Talk a little bit, if you would, Raymond, about whether there is hope for a secular opposition to the Islamists of one stripe or another, and what American policy should be. In contrast, if you would quickly characterize what you think it is at the moment.
Well, I think it all depends on who wins this war between the Muslim Brotherhood and the military, whether the secular liberals can have any real space in Egypt. They're not the dominant group. They are, in fact, riding the military tiger at the moment, as they did against Mubarak, ironically. They were in a real hurry to get Mubarak's successors in the military out. And that was actually going to lead to the Muslim Brotherhood taking over. They didn't seem to mind then because they were unaware of how the Muslim Brotherhood would actually rule. But now they've had a year of experience with the Muslim Brotherhood. They're determined to keep them from remaining in power or getting back into power. So the military is their ally at the moment. The military is actually appointed. So Sisi, this Islamist, has actually appointed an all-secular cabinet.
One of whom, of course, Mohammed el-Baradei has resigned in protest over the clearing of the streets by the government of Egypt of these Brotherhood occupiers. Does he figure prominently in this secular future, if any at all?
No. I think he took himself out of it by resigning.
Okay. Let me ask you, if I may, Raymond Stock, we're almost out of time, but I want to get your thoughts on this. Bill Gertz, one of our contributors here at Secure Freedom Radio, has written at the Washington Free Beacon that there seems to be some interest on the part of the Egyptian military in light of how unreliable the United States government has proven to be, and indeed how closely it has been allied with the Muslim Brotherhood, that it's time to go back to its previous relationship with Russia, and maybe with China now, as more likely to be there when they need them. Do you see that in prospect? And again, what might that mean for us as well as the Egyptian people?
I do see that as a real possibility. If we've decided now to cut off our aid, as President Obama was making statements today to the effect that we're considering seriously cutting off the aid, we stopped the biannual military, the joint military exercises we have with Egypt called Bright Star, which were scheduled for September. And he's also very seriously considering cutting off the aid. He's under a lot of pressure from some of the Republicans in Congress to cut off aid.
The friends of the Muslim Brotherhood, like Lindsey Graham and John McCain.
Well, they certainly did go over there and try to get Morsi out of jail. So
and the Brotherhood back in the political process.
Back in politics and back in power. And that's what the Obama administration actually wants to see happen.
What would it mean if Egypt were to realign with Russia at a moment like this, in your judgment? Very quickly.
Very, very bad for us because they control the Suez. I mean, they're on the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal, we get a lot of privileges out of our relationship with Egypt, far beyond keeping the peace with Israel, which is extremely important. And that includes jumping to the head of the line when you have a crisis. You have to send your ships through the Suez Canal to respond to a crisis overseas, you know, east of Suez or whatever. So or going back the other way. So you really have to have an ability to get through the Suez Canal quickly. And that's only one thing we get from Egypt. There are many others.
Raymond, we need to have you come back and talk at greater length with us about those many different ways in which this relationship is important. You've mentioned a couple: counterterrorism, Israel, the Suez Canal, and not least, I think, standing up against our mutual enemy, the Muslim Brotherhood. Thank you for your work at the Middle East Forum. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, Roger W. Robinson joins us to talk about the judge, President Reagan's top hand, who just recently passed away. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We are joined by Roger W. Robinson, Jr., a man I have had the privilege of knowing and working with closely over many years. Unfortunately, we're brought together by a bit of unhappy news, namely the recent passing of a man that Roger worked with very closely for a very long period of time, both in government and subsequently. His name was Judge William P. Clark. I got to know him thanks to Roger late in his life, after the Reagan years, and came to admire him tremendously. And Roger, I'm so grateful to you for sharing a few moments with us to talk about Judge Clark, as he was universally known, the man, and then talk a bit about some of his accomplishments. But you were at his funeral in the central coast of California earlier this week. Tell us a little bit about Judge Clark, the man, as you knew him.
Well, thank you, Frank. There was a very moving ceremony for Bill Clark's funeral at a chapel that he had built like a Spanish church of old on a beautiful hill on his land that is for the entire community to enjoy, and what a fitting place for him. This was an exceptional human being. I've never known anyone of greater integrity, forthrightness, dignity, and selflessness. There was a great humility about the man, and he was Ronald Reagan's quintessential alter ego. They had an implicit communication, almost telepathic in the way they could relate to one another. And I had the chance to see that almost nonverbal communication close at hand, and it was something exceptional. And one can only imagine their history together, going through chief of staff as governor of California, his designated Supreme Court justice, that is Governor Reagan at the time, in California, and onward to
the Washington years. We're talking with Roger Robinson. He is formerly was the senior director for international economic affairs and played a really incalculably important role working with Judge Clark, then the national security advisor to the president on the Reagan National Security Council staff. Roger has just come back from the funeral where Judge Clark was honored at his passing at 81. And Roger, you were just getting into what I really think is the most important piece of this subject for our audience, namely what Judge Clark did with Ronald Reagan during the years you served with them together in the administration, to free literally hundreds of millions of people from the tyranny of Soviet enslavement. Tell us a little bit about the role Judge Clark played in all of that.
Well, first, Frank, Judge Clark saw the Cold War as a moral conflict and struggle between good and evil, between truth and lies. Just that simple, that there could be no reconciliation of these two. The evil empire was seen as such, and it was only going to free men and women if it had its demise hastened. And he worked tirelessly on that, recruiting a number of us in very different fields to come up with opportunities to put enormous pressure on a creaking and untenable Soviet system. But in my case, it was the economic, financial, and technology portfolios, with a large component of which was energy. And the whole interest of the president and Judge Clark in what they were executing in their minds as part of the DP, or divine plan, as both were men of unshakable faith, was to stress out the Soviet economy, to defund the evil empire, to put constraints on their various means of earning hard currency, of gaining access to Western loans and credits, both from official governments like those in Western Europe, as well as commercial banks, which it turned out were providing 100% of the life support needed to bridge the difference between Soviet expenditures and hard currency income, of which there was a disparity of some $15 to $16 billion a year that they spent more than they made. And we, the West, were underwriting the difference. The president found this utterly unacceptable, as did Judge Clark, but it was Judge Clark that fashioned the strategy, a multi-pronged strategy involving the military dimensions and, of course, the military buildup that was administered so ably by Kapp Weinberger, Bill Casey stressing them out in the Third World from Afghanistan to the harbors of Nicaragua, Jean Kirkpatrick and her truth-telling at the United Nations, those of us in the economic and financial portfolio that were concentrating on limiting their sales of natural gas to Western Europe, which would have bailed out in large part, damaged the Soviet economy. The credit dimension I mentioned in terms of thwarting their ability to gain access to Western forms of life support, financial and otherwise. And the list went on. And, of course, the deployment of Pershing's and cruise missiles, the fear of SDI. So there were a number of elements, but I think that, Frank, the bottom line is that someone had to pull together all these various pressure points and strands into one highly secret, cohesive strategy. And that genius was Bill Clark.
Indeed. Roger Robinson is our guest. He formerly served with Judge Clark on the National Security Council staff, playing, as he's mentioned, an instrumental role in devising and helping to execute the strategy that took down the Soviet Union. Roger, you mentioned that it was a creaking, tottering empire. It was not seen as such by many at the time. And in fact, talk very quickly about the kind of pressure that the president and, of course, the judge and yourself came under to keep this strategy from being implemented, to finish off what in fact proved to be a much more fragile evil empire than was widely perceived.
Well, you're correct that there was enormous pushback within the cabinet of the United States, the president's own team, as well as the Congress, the business community, and the Western allies, particularly those domiciled in Western Europe. And I mean ferocious pushback. This was seen as a irritant, a gratuitous irritant to the alliance relationship. It was doomed to fail in the view of most of the cabinet, of the president's own team. There were a few stalwarts only that stuck by this strategy, among them Judge Clark, of course, in the lead with Bill Casey, then Director of Central Intelligence. Berger, of course, administering the pressure points in the Department of Defense. So it was not a a pretty picture. There were a few of us on the NSC staff that were directly involved in the execution of the strategy, but it was being systematically undermined at times by the upstairs of the White House Chief of Staff office, as well as the State Department, of course, Commerce, and the United States Trade Representative. Anyone in the economic and commercial arena tended to be very negative toward the strategy. The Congress was hearing from the business community, which was squealing over the loss of contracts that they were going to attain with the construction of the largest project in East-West history, namely the Siberian Gas Pipeline Project at $35 billion, which was an immense sum at the time.
It was, and in short, Roger Robinson, a time of choosing, and the president, his top hand, Judge William P. Clark, you yourself and that handful of others made all the difference. We salute all of you, and we say farewell to a remarkable man. Again, I can't tell you how enriched I felt by having him as a friend and a mentor in my life, and I know you feel the same. Roger, thank you for sharing this important reminiscence of your time with Judge Clark. Keep up the good work at RWR Advisory Group, and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Mark Krikorian about the immigration debate, where it's going now, and where it should go. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth. and the 10th. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama announced yesterday that he is reviewing America's relationship with Egypt's government in the wake of its crackdown on Muslim Brotherhood sympathizers. What's most urgently in need of review, however, is Team Obama's own role in creating the conditions that led to the present crisis in Egypt. By realigning U.S. policy with the Muslim Brotherhood, it emboldened and then empowered Islamists who are not only the enemies of freedom there, they are our enemies as well. If Mr. Obama continues such behavior, he may well drive the Egyptian government into the arms of the Russians and Chinese, nations unfriendly to us, but seen as far more reliable than we are under this administration. If that happens, we have only begun to see the full costs of Team Obama's mistakes. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back, joined by Mark Krikorian. He is the president of a remarkable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. It is truly an indispensable resource, particularly at a moment like this, when the nation is in the throes of one of its, well, I guess, generational debates about what to do about illegal aliens, undocumented workers, they're sometimes called, but illegal aliens who are now in this country by the millions and more, who seek to get here if the borders remain open as they are now. And there is the further inducement of amnesty, which is now being presented to them by a bipartisan bill adopted by the Senate recently and now under some degree of consideration in the House. Mark Krikorian, thank you for finding a few minutes to talk with us about what's going on in a momentous August recess period that may shape the future of this legislation and indeed the destiny of our country. It's good to have you with us as always.
Glad to be here.
Mark, set the stage for us again, if you would, please. What's in the Senate bill? What's wrong with it from your perspective?
Three basic parts to the Senate bill. The first is amnesty for all the illegal immigrants. In other words, they get legal status. The second is promises of enforcement at some point in the future. The legal status part happens pretty much right away. And then the third part is huge increases in future immigration, doubling of legal immigration, doubling of guest workers. So those three things, and the core objection, there's a lot of things to object to, but really the fundamental problem with the bill is that it legalizes all the illegal aliens before the enforcement promises are supposed to be kept years later. And as we saw back in 1986 with similar legislation that passed, is that the amnesty will happen up front and the promises of enforcement will peter out over time and won't be kept.
And what is the practical effect of that on illegal immigration flows?
Well, what it's going to do most certainly is continue legal immigration. In other words, it's being sold as a way of ending illegal immigration, but fixing the status of past mistakes, people who got in the past. The thing is that even the Congressional Budget Office, with its skewed, politically shaped report, even they acknowledge that this report, that this Senate bill, would only reduce illegal immigration somewhat, maybe a third, maybe even a half at most. And part of the problem is that the increases in legal immigration in the bill will actually foster more illegal immigration, as well as the enforcement stuff, not happening and illegal immigration continuing. So, it's a bait and switch. Promises of enforcement won't be kept, but the amnesty is offered in exchange for those promises.
And again, as you say, Mark Krikorian, we've seen this movie before. This goes to the point of shame on us if we're susceptible to this bait and switch yet again. Talk about the House at the moment.
We saw this in 1986. Where, like I said, a similar bill was offered. President Reagan ended up signing the bill. It was 5 or 6 years in the works, but it was the first time we'd done a big amnesty. And the deal in exchange for that was banning employment of illegal immigrants for the first time ever, because before that it was legal. And so, at the time, I can't say I would have been against it because, it was plausible. It was worth a try. It's just that we now understand that those kind of deals where the left gets what it wants first, and then everybody else gets what they want later, that those kind of deals are inherently flawed. It's like that Popeye cartoon, the character Wimpy. He would say, I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. Well, he never paid, and, we need to get paid first before we give them any hamburgers.
This is not a cartoon. This is real life. Talk a little bit, Mark Krikorian, of the Center for Immigration Studies about what's going on in the House of Representatives at the moment. Will we see action on this bill or a kind of subterfuge that enables it to become law even though the House will not vote for it?
What's happening in the House is the House leadership, which the Republican leadership, as on so many other issues, are pusillanimous and spineless. They have said, they're against the Senate bill, but they want to pass piecemeal legislation, separate targeted bills, instead of one giant bill that deal with these various issues. And the fear is that the Speaker of the House will go to conference with the Senate. In other words, they meet to iron out the differences between the legislation, and that he will then cave in and simply adopt the Senate bill. And if he were to present it to the House, it might pass because all the Democrats would vote for it, and it would only need a small number of Republicans, and there's enough weak Republicans that it could pass if he were to do that. That's the real danger coming up probably in October, because when they come back to work in September, there's not that many days they're going to be working and there are other issues to deal with. So the thing to look for in October will the House Republican leadership stand firm and say, look, we passed these piecemeal measures, enforcement and other things, and if the Senate wants to talk about them, they can call us, but we're not going to meet about and talk about their bill.
Which, by the way, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee has said is an unconstitutional bill because it raises revenue out of the Senate without the House having enacted it first. Mark Krikorian, this makes obviously what happens in August very important in terms of the decisions that the House Republican leadership might take. I know there are some demonstrations or other kinds of events planned in Speaker John Boehner's district, for example, I think by both proponents and opponents of this amnesty legislation. Tell us a little bit about what's going on the ground in August and how people can help, if they choose to, prevent this kind of amnesty from being enacted.
All over the country, both sides are taking advantage of the fact that the House members are back at home in their districts doing meetings and town halls and chicken dinners and all the kind of things that are important for congressmen to do. The pro-amnesty people, for instance, had a demonstration in California in Congressman McCarthy's district. He's part of the Republican leadership. It was much smaller than expected. It was a good-sized number of people. I heard it was like 1,000 people, but they were saying they had 5,000 coming. So it really was kind of a disappointment on their side. In Speaker Boehner's district, a bunch of sheriffs have gotten together, including the sheriff of his own home county, as well as others, to make the case this is bad from a law enforcement perspective. So that's happening all over the country, kind of on both sides, and that's going to be one of the things that shapes Republican members' perceptions of what the public thinks about this bill.
Very important, in short, for each of us to make our voices heard in whatever way we can. And my personal favorite is to go to the district offices, which are generally the place where these members count on their staffs to keep their pulse on the sentiments of their constituents. Mark, in closing, let me just ask you a question about Marco Rubio. He has played a very important role in crafting the Senate bill and helping to sell it. He's been kind of all over the lot. Senator Rubio has got to office as a darling of conservatives and the Tea Party. This has been horrifying to many of them, I think. He most recently, as I understand it, has said that, well, we have to pass this legislation because President Obama will, as is now his wont increasingly, just enact or adopt or execute, if you will, amnesty unilaterally if we don't. What's your response to Marco Rubio?
Yes, that's definitely what Senator Rubio said. Senator Rubio is basically engaging in a kind of blackmail, saying that if we don't pass the amnesty, President Obama will just do it on his own. And instead of saying that means we should, you know, oppose any efforts on his part to unconstitutionally usurp the power of Congress, Rubio is offering that as an argument for voting for his bill. It's basically like, you know, let's give the bank robbers money so that they don't rob the bank. I mean, I can't imagine anybody takes this seriously, and it's really just one more step in Senator Rubio's kind of delegitimation in the eyes of conservatives.
Indeed it is, and a shame at that because he seemed to have such promise. Mark Krikorian, I thank you very much for this analysis and for the great work that you do at the Center for Immigration Studies. You're helping all of us both understand this complex piece of legislation and most especially recognize what is our responsibility to try to prevent it from becoming law. Thank you for joining us as always. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, Luis Fleischman joins us to talk about, among other things, John Kerry's travels in Latin America and what they mean for you. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com. Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Luis Fleischman. He is a senior advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project. I'm very pleased to say at the Center for Security Policy. He contributes to its terrific online publication, The Americas Report. He is also the author of a marvelous book entitled Latin America in the Post-Chavez Era, The Security Threat to the United States. He's one of our go-to guys on what is happening south of our border. And John Kerry has been in that part of the world recently. And we wanted to catch up with Luis to take stock of what he's been up to and what it says about American policy towards the hemisphere. Luis, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to be with you here, Frank.
Terrific. Let's start with Kerry's visits to Brazil and to Colombia. Were there any surprises to you in terms of either the attention that he's giving now to the region and what he actually did while he was there?
Well, it wasn't clear from the beginning to me what was the purpose of the visit. We knew that he wanted to deepen relations, of course, with Colombia, which is an ally, and of course with Brazil, that is not clear, is not really an ally, even though the media claim that it is an ally. I think it could potentially be an ally. And obviously most of the talks were supposed to be about trade and all kinds of things. But the trip has been totally overshadowed by two elements here. One is the spy case, the NSA spying case, which is still not clear. We don't know too many details about, and it's not clear why so much spying on Brazil, and that's something that I would really like to know. And obviously that distorted the whole trip of Kerry to Brazil. Hopefully on October 23rd, the president of Brazil will come and meet with President Obama at the White House. In the case of Colombia, which was supposed to be also about trade, in Colombia, because of the spying, also was not, John Kerry was not well received either, not necessarily by the government, but by protest outside. But what really surprised me, since you asked me the question of surprise, is the fact that John Kerry provided backing to the negotiations with the FARC, negotiations that actually have been sponsored by the governments of Venezuela and Cuba. This is a very fishy, and I'm not saying that people should not reach out in order to make peace. I'm not against peace in general. But I don't know to what extent we understand who the FARC are, namely the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, and what the FARC is going to do in the aftermath of a peace agreement, if there is a peace agreement with Colombia. Remember, the FARC is not only a subversive movement in Colombia. The FARC is also a movement that is working for the Bolivarian Revolution, is working for Hugo Chavez. I mean, the movement that was founded by Hugo Chavez, and at this point they are active all over Latin America, serving as a subversive force in favor of the Bolivarian Revolution, and obviously serving as one of the paramilitary groups protecting the Chavez government.
This is, needless to say, an enemy entity. It's been designated as a terrorist group by the United States government, and properly so. And for many years, it was impossible, I think, clearly, for the Colombian government to make peace with these guys. And I'm fearful that it won't be any more likely to be accomplished now. But let's back the lens up a little bit further. Luis Fleischman, a senior advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project at the Center for Security Policy. Your book, as I mentioned, is about the post-Chavez era in Latin America. Talk a little bit about what is happening elsewhere in the region to governments with which the, Hugo Chavez regime was very closely aligned, perhaps starting in Argentina with Madame Kirchner's government. What's the latest on her status?
This is very interesting because what we witnessed on Sunday was a major defeat for the Kirchner supporters in the primary of Argentina. They had what is called obligatory primaries. They took place in last Sunday, and basically what we saw there was a defeat for the Kirchner sector within the Peronist Party, and a couple of major leaders claim that that's the end of the era of Kirchnerism. We don't know yet because we are still waiting for the elections in October, and who knows what's going to happen then. But the reality is that Kirchner basically presented her government, or the way she portrayed her government was the government of the people against the enemies of the people. So she represents the people. But now the people kick her out. I mean, she's not out, don't get me wrong. She's still the president and there is still support for her there. But it was a major defeat for an arrogant government that ruled in a very bully way. Even though it was elected democratically, it didn't rule democratically, tried to control the judiciary, tried to control parliament in any way, tried to limit the scope of the media, tried to intimidate people. In other words, the government of Argentina was Chavismo, didn't reach the extremes of Chavism, but was Chavism nonetheless.
Right, and very hostile to the United States as well, Luis Fleischman.
A little bit more subtly hostile to the United States, but hostile nonetheless.
Indeed. And one of the interesting things here is there seem to be some shifts being undertaken in other parts of this region as well. We talk frequently, as you know, with Roger Noriega about this, and he pointed out one that caught me by surprise, frankly, namely Peru, where we had a Chavez character or wannabe, perhaps, elected there a while back. But he says he is seemingly ruling Humala with a much more restrained manner, specifically with respect to the sort of socialist agenda, nationalizing industries and so on, than might have been expected. Was that a surprise to you? And is it perhaps a straw in the wind of what's going to happen to other Chavez wannabes in the region?
Well, I agree with you 100%, and I agree with Roger Noriega. The Peruvian president, Ollanta Humala, indeed surprised. He's following basically a policy that is more like the Brazilian policy of basically supporting private enterprise, supporting industry, and at the same time trying to create some sort of mechanism of redistribution, if you wish, some social welfare. So didn't follow the Chavez model, even though Ollanta Humala himself received money, funds from Chavez to create turmoil in Peru. And he did. They indeed were allies. But once he was elected to office, he's behaving in a different way. Now, is this a setback for Chavism? I think to a certain extent, I think a lot of people already saw in Latin America that the Chavez model is an extreme model that they don't want to follow. But on the other hand, whether I would say this is the beginning of the end of Chavism, no, not at all. I think the dangers are there, and that's the point of my book, because the structure that Chavez created is already very well rooted in Venezuela and among its allies, which is not only an authoritarian structure, but also all these alliances with the FARC, with the drug cartels, with Iran. The Iranian presence in Latin America is increasing.
It is indeed. And all of these are the sorts of reasons why we want to pay close attention to what is happening in the hemisphere. And I hope that our government is as well. I'm not terribly encouraged by John Kerry's performance down there, but I'm very encouraged, as always, by the attention that you're giving it, Luis Fleischman, and I know that you'll continue to do so. Luis, once again, senior advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project at the Center for Security Policy. Check out his writing at the Americas Report and also his book, Latin America in the Post-Chavez Era, The Security Threat to the United States. And check us out again next week, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.